Hello, welcome to the House of Comments podcast. This is a regular podcast featuring me, Mark Thompson, Lib Dem blogger, and usually featuring my co-host Emma Burnell, but Emma's not with us today because I'm actually in Glasgow at the Lib Dem conference. And joining me today for a special one-off podcast are Karen Lindsay, who is a very long-time Lib Dem activist, very, very long-time Lib Dem activist, and also co-editor of Lib Dem Voice. Good morning, Karen.
Hello, I'm not that old, you know.
And also joining me, I'm delighted to say, is Nick Thornsby, who is also a Lib Dem blogger and also writes for Lib Dem Voice and is going to be a pupil barrister soon, I think.
Yes, thank you.
Good to have you both. So the first thing I just want to ask you both is just, we're on the second morning of the conference now, so it's the Sunday morning, so obviously we've had kind of one nearly full day. Just to get your temperature of how you think things are going. Karen, do you want to kick us off?
Well, I think conference is always like a family gathering. But I had to nip off yesterday to a family gathering of my own, and we were all sitting around, having a bit of banter, having a bit of fun, and just enjoying ourselves and celebrating. And that was a bit like the Liberal Democrat Voice Awards last night. We had quite a lot of the party luminaries. We had the three UK leaders, and they all came in and they had a good time. The press is talking about, you know, splits and confrontations, but there was Nick Clegg having a good laugh with some of, you know, his fiercest critics in the party, and just enjoying some downtime and celebrating the best of the Liberal Democrats, our favourite MPs, parliamentarians, councillors. Nick presented the award to Abby Bell from Hull, who has led a fantastic fight back after terrible elections in 2011. So it was all, you know, I think people are pretty upbeat.
And Nick, what is your temperature of the conference so far?
I think everybody who attends conference always reads in the media in the run-up the sort of predictions about it, Nick Clegg's position, all this sort of, and it always rings fairly hollow when you're here. Certainly this time, I don't think there's any desire to weaken Nick Clegg's position, which I think he's quite strong. As a few people have said, if the only person who's calling for you to go is Lord Oakeshott, then I think you can consider your position pretty secure.
It's like a perennial thing, isn't it?
Exactly,
every conference now, you know, Matthew Oakeshott pops up and has something to say, doesn't he?
Yeah, no, exactly. And I heard somebody yesterday suggest that next year we should get in ahead of him and release his comments 2 weeks before he does.
Or maybe have a sweepstake on precisely when he's going to release his comments.
Yes.
But it's not just Oakeshott, you see, it's Lembit as well.
Oh, yes, yes.
Oh, really?
He's done it. Now, there's a surprise.
It's definitely the fringes of the party then, isn't it?
Yeah.
I actually don't think, we'll talk about the motions, I think, later, but I don't get any real sense from among members that there's a desire to give Nick Clegg a kicking on anything, really. There will be debates over policy, but I don't think there's a desire just to give him a bloody nose in itself for the sake of it.
Oh, absolutely not. I think that when people are voting on Trident, they're voting on whether they want nuclear weapons or not. They're not thinking, oh, I want to give Nick Clegg a kicking.
Yeah.
And that's exactly the same as on all the other issues as well. We are a thinking conference. We have quality debates, and we make our minds up accordingly. And we tend to do it for policy geeky reasons, not for spite.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so I mean, yeah, we will move on to some of the specific motions, but just generally, neither of you think that Nick Clegg's got much to worry about at this conference then?
No, Nick Clegg's going to lead us into the 2015 general election.
Absolutely no doubt about that. He's had really, there was a few patchy bits over the summer, but he's actually had very, very good year, I think, doing great things. The Call Clegg thing has been absolutely fantastic,
yeah.
Taking the calls every Thursday morning, coming over as a real human being. And you know, I think people are getting to know him. And actually, I think there's some evidence now that people actually like him. So I think we need to get him out there more and more and more.
I think the economic recovery, such as it is, helps as well, because it remove some of the doubts that members would have, but also members of the public, you know, sort of lingering doubts at whether the coalition is doing the right thing. The economy starts to pick up, and particularly living standards now start to rise. I think that will give him a spring in his step and make his position yet more secure.
Although I don't think Nick would particularly argue with what Vince was saying the other day, is that you've got very small signs of economic recovery, but we can't take anything for granted, and we have to make sure that we lay down foundations for a sustained recovery for the future.
Okay, so Do either of you think that there is anything coming up that you think is going to be controversial? I mean, the media keep talking about how the conference, you know, that there are certain things that potentially going to come up that are going to be like an embarrassment, in quotes, to the leadership. I mean, in terms of what is coming up, do you think there is anything that's likely to embarrass the leadership, even though it might not threaten his, you know, Clegg's leadership? Do you think that there are things that might just embarrass him?
Don't think there's anything controversial coming up, is there, Karen? Only across the conference?
Only about 15 different separate votes on things like the economy and nuclear power and Trident and fracking. That's what we're looking forward to today, nuclear power and fracking.
And porn.
Indeed, yes.
It sounds like a really good party. Yeah.
I think there's actually going to be, I think that's another thing that's energised the conference, is that they know that there's going to be some real quality debates, because quite often you'll come, you look at the agenda and you'll think, there's nothing here really that excites me, but this year there's lots to excite. There's lots of talking going on about different policy options around the scenes. One of the ones I'm particularly interested in is the debate on protecting children from online pornography that's taking place this afternoon. The motion and the amendment are both very technologically driven about, you know, the use of filters. In fact, the motion talks about verifiable proof of age. So, you know, your 11-year-old pinches your passport and puts your details into a dodgy website. that's not going to help protect anybody. Whereas other people are thinking that actually what you build around education. So it's about talk, not technology. It's about giving young people kind of proper information about sexual health and relationships and things like that. In fact, Nick Clegg talked about that on Call Clegg the other week. When a 17-year-old actually rang up and asked him about this. I mean, when I was 17, if I'd asked a politician about, if I had the nerve to ask a politician about sex education, they would have run away. Mm. But Nick, like the responsible kind of parent he is, was perfectly open, quite happy to discuss it with her. And I think that's really, really good. And we could make some very bad policy this afternoon, but hopefully we won't. We'll refer it back for another time or vote it down.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to get slightly technical into the standing orders of the Liberal Democrats, but
Do you want to actually just want to explain what referring back means for people who don't know? Because Nick Clegg even made a joke about that during his rally speech last night. It's clearly a bit of a Lib Dem in joke, so.
All right. It basically means that if conference isn't happy with a particular policy but doesn't want to vote it down, they can say, OK, policy committee, can you just take this and have another look at it and bring listen to the points that have been made in the debate and bring another motion back in the future?
Yeah, I definitely think the best outcome will be a referral back. It was always going to be a nightmare, this motion, because if we... members are always going to be unhappy with it. If we vote it down, you know, we can all see the headlines in tomorrow's Daily Mail. Not that will concern too many members, but, you know, it's not ideal. I think a referral by it's obviously not been thought through particularly. It's probably a fairly rush motion. David Cameron didn't make his comments on this until fairly recently. So I think it doesn't need some more thought. I'm looking forward to this is going to sound extremely sad. I'm looking forward to the energy debate today. Yeah. The two flashpoints in that debate are going to be nuclear power and fracking. I don't know about you guys. I'm in favour of both, but that's certainly on fracking. That's a minority position in the party. Nuclear power is going to be very interesting.
Well, I grew up in the shadow of Dounreay in Caithness. So obviously that was a big employer in the area. But on the other hand, you saw from what happened at Chernobyl, the effects that, the long-term effects that happen when things go wrong. And I'm actually against any new nuclear. We have massive potential in renewables, and that's where all the money should go. We should not be putting money into new nuclear, and Scotland particularly can lead the way on that.
I think it's interesting because the party's fairly united on its green credentials in wanting to combat climate change, and there's now a slight division between, I suppose, what you might call the sort of pragmatists and those who want to stick with the renewables, which ultimately will be the future. People like Chris Davis, who do MEP in the Northwest, who do an awful lot of work on climate change in the European Parliament. He's supporting both nuclear power and fracking, particularly if it includes when the gas is burnt to produce the electricity, if it includes carbon capture and storage technology, which he's done a lot of work on. So he's supporting those new technologies for the precise reason that they give us a better chance of reducing carbon emissions and combating climate change.
Maybe if we can just unpack fracking slightly, because we have covered it on the podcast before, and I've been doing some reading. In fact, I actually, when I went on holiday a few weeks ago, I took away, one of the things was a video of a BBC thing from a few months ago by Dr. Ian Stewart.
Well, you definitely sound sadder than me now, Mark.
Yeah, I am pretty sad, Nick. But, you know, the listeners know that. And I actually watched it on the plane, and it was very interesting because I suppose quite a lot of what I'd heard about fracking had come from the anti-fracking side. So I had it in my mind that it was definitely dangerous and it was a massive risk doing this. And the programme was a lot more balanced than that. It said that there have been some problems, although the exact nature of the problems is unclear. And it appears to be that the best scientific evidence that they've got is that it's only really a problem if the shafts aren't insulated correctly. If they're insulated correctly, then the chance of there being leakage of gas into water supplies is minimal, if not basically impossible given the way things are structured. But there have been some examples where it is suspected it has happened, but it's been because the wells haven't basically been drilled correctly. And if that's the case, then the safety issue would seem to be perhaps a more minor question than whether or not we just want to be releasing more carbon into the atmosphere, which maybe is a more fundamental question. And I mean, I think as Nick, you just said about Chris Davis, I've been wondering about if this could be developed in tandem with carbon capture and storage. Maybe this could be a win-win. I mean, what do you think, Karen?
I have to say that this is one of these issues that I'm actually going to listen to the debate on. Mm-hmm. I actually don't know enough about it, I think, to be able to say anything. I think that you do. I mean, I what you're saying makes an awful lot of sense. It's got to be done in a way that is pretty tightly controlled. And we need to be constantly looking at the evidence and evaluating what's happening if it is going to take place. But I'm always worried about things that take efforts away from and take resources away from renewables, things like that.
But need it do? Because if the private sector can fund this fracking stuff, as I believe that is what's happening, well, okay, let's caveat that slightly. George Osborne has engineered things to, and if companies are getting tax breaks, then effectively they're being subsidised by the public purse, aren't they? So it's maybe not quite as straightforward as that. But I think predominantly it's the companies that are funding this. So is there really any reason why they can't fund that? And also at the same time, we crack on with renewables as we should?
But if there are kind of wider consequences in terms of things getting into the water supply, the potential of that, we need to be very careful about making sure that's not going to happen before we allow it. We need to have proper evidence-based policy making.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. We like to pride ourselves on evidence-based policy making. There's an interesting report from the Royal Society who looked at the evidence from the test wells in Blackpool area. Basically, they found no evidence of water contamination or of fracking causing earth tremors or earthquakes. I think there's an amendment, I don't know if you've both seen that, to the motion, which Chris Davis is speaking on, in fact, which basically suggests that because shale gas will be taxed in the same way that North Sea oil is, so that a really quite high proportion of the sale price is paid. And the amendment basically says that should go into a fund to fund renewable research. And it also says that shale gas shouldn't allow us to miss the carbon targets that we've set. So I think properly regulated, keeping a close eye on the evidence, I'm in favour of fracking. Ultimately, we are going to be either importing gas from Norway or we're going to be getting it from under the ground in Blackpool.
Well, I think that's a key point, isn't it? I mean, I don't I think that if we go full steam ahead on fracking, ultimately there will be more carbon released into the atmosphere than there wouldn't have been. I don't think it would be a completely straight swap, because that gas that's being produced in other countries will be sold to other people. And, you know, if there's more supply, people will find ways of using it, I suspect. But the question of energy security for me is one that's paramount. I mean, I remember seeing a Newsnight programme like in 2003, and they were talking about the lights going out by the middle of the next decade. Well, we're pretty much there now. Now, the lights aren't going out yet, but I do worry that because governments are so short-term generally, that we could just find ourselves in a position in a few years' time where the lights are going out because governments of different stripes haven't made the necessary the necessary decisions. And it feels to me a bit like fracking at least would help mitigate against that.
And it's also a sort of bridge, because a lot of the renewable technologies are not quite there yet. They'll take a bit more work and it could be quite a bit more investment. So if we can get relatively cheap gas to act as a bridge that can help fund that renewable research, but provide us with that energy security until those renewable technologies are better developed, I think that's a fairly sensible policy.
I have to say, though, I do think that probably the majority of the Lib Dems agree with you, Karen. Some evidence of this, quite a lot of the people who follow me and I follow on Twitter are Lib Dems. I follow people in other parties as well. But when I suggested a few weeks ago that I maybe wasn't, you know, against fracking and maybe we should give it a chance, I got quite a lot of vitriol coming back from, in some cases, Lib Dems, but actually Labour people as well. It does seem like, you know, the further left you go, the more opposed to fracking you are. So I think, I don't know how the debate in the party is going to go with this, but it certainly feels like there's quite a lot of scepticism about whether this is the right thing to do. And I think perhaps the majority of the view is with you, Karen.
Well, I'm going to listen to the debate and make up my mind accordingly, I think.
Okay.
So I think that's...
So you wouldn't at the moment say you're against it necessarily?
I think instinctively I probably lean to be more worried about it. But if somebody can persuade me that the evidence is supports it will be properly controlled and regulated, then I might be persuaded to vote for it. Probably the amendment more than the actual motion.
Yeah, I think that's
it. The motion is a little open-ended.
Yeah, I think that the amendment will be passed, and it's quite clever in that it will, in being passed, will basically get Congress to support fracking. It depends how the speaker cards go, the balance of the speakers, but I think nuclear power will probably be the more... will dominate the debate more. And certainly that's what Ed Davies and the leadership are most worried about, because, you know, fracking will make a slight difference to the energy market. Nuclear is potentially a massive proportion of the energy market in the future. And Ed Davies, very keen on it, on us being open at least to new nuclear. And I think he's very concerned. They've been doing a lot of work before conference to sort of get the facts out there, try and persuade members to support it.
I have one other slight theory about why fracking has become controversial so quickly. And I think it's at least partly because the word frack sounds a bit rude. And it can be kind of used in campaigns such as frack off.
Yeah.
And, you
fracking
know,
ridiculous, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it is absolutely fracking ridiculous. So there you go. But that's just my little theory. Okay. Well, maybe if we move on to... I wanted to talk about the economy as well. So, Nick, do you want to start us off on what's going to be debated about the economy and how you think things might pan out?
Yes, another non-controversial motion. Yeah. Basically, what happened is that three economy motions were submitted to the FCC. One from the Social Liberal Forum, one from Liberal Reform, which I'm co-chair of, and one from the party leadership. The one from the party leadership was accepted. What it basically does is endorse the... coalition's record in particularly when it comes to deficit reduction in the strategy of trying to get public spending under control, and then has a number of suggestions for the future, particularly in terms of investing in green technology, business bank, continue what Vince has been doing, all that sort of stuff. So my view is, I mean, I'm sort of naturally in favour of that sort of motion anyway, but I think it's a good motion. And I'm supportive of it. So, inevitably enough, there were amendments submitted. Two amendments. My amendment, in fact, was accepted as a drafting amendment on the trade policy. So that will be in the motion. But two amendments submitted by the Social Liberal Forum, basically trying to weaken the part on deficit reduction and calling for some other things: council and house building, slightly odd section on Bank of England mandate. But basically they'll be seen as a challenge to Nick Clegg, a challenge to the coalition's record. Social Liberal Forum say that what they want to do is distance the Lib Dems from what will be the Conservative position in 2015, and they don't think the motion does that sufficiently. So there was some suggestion late last week that perhaps the leadership wouldn't oppose the amendments, but it's clear now that they are going to oppose them. Steve Webb is proposing the motion as a whole. He was fairly heavily involved in Social Liberal Forum when it was founded, so that's obviously a very canny move by the party leadership to get him to speak in favour of the motion against the amendments. It will still be a close vote, I think, probably a counted vote.
Yeah. Is Nick Clegg summating, did I read?
Yes.
Okay, because that seems like a bit of a risk.
Yes.
Because he'll be basically front and centre if it goes against the leadership.
But it's not unprecedented for that to happen. The last time we had a Trident vote, Ming Campbell summed up the debate. And in Scotland, when Willie Rennie changed the position of the Scottish Liberal Democrat into supporting minimum alcohol pricing, which was quite a difficult question for the party, he set about persuading the party, and he actually spoke and summed up the debate in a very thoughtful and persuasive way. And I think tomorrow we've got the opportunity to have a really fantastic, intelligent debate. I think the amendments from the Social Liberal Forum are actually very kind of economically credible, very well crafted, and also they accept the economic achievements that the coalition has made and the things that the Liberal Democrats have put into the coalition. They're quite happy with that. And if the motion is passed just as it is, it will, you know, I wouldn't cry too long into my beer, but I think that the Social Liberal Forum amendment, particularly on housing, we are desperately needing affordable housing, and getting the construction industry moving again and giving councils the freedom to borrow and things like that on housing, it's really, really important. You know, when I worked for an MP, we had maybe five families a week coming and saying they couldn't even get a decent house that they could afford. And I think this gives us the opportunity to do something really distinctive and radical about that. And I think the tone of the debate will be important, because we can talk about the issues and have this really intelligent debate, or I think the tone on both sides is going to be quite important. If people round about Nick Clegg are kind of looking at this as an opportunity to give the Social Liberal Forum a kicking, I would suggest that they don't do that. I don't think it's helpful. I think we need to concentrate on the issues, because that's actually what matters. Because you talk about economy and figures and numbers, but it's not about that. It's about people. It's about where they live. It's about how they work. And we owe it to people to look at the issues intelligently. On the other hand, the tone of the people proposing the amendments is also really, really important, because I do think it's important to recognise what the Liberal Democrats have achieved in the government, and also not to look like they're about to give Nick Clegg a pay stick. So that's, you know.
I mean, this was basically a fight that Nick Clegg wanted to have, because he feels that he's on the right side of the argument. The economy is starting to recover.
Do you think that makes a difference?
Definitely, because, and it's not just that, you know, the banks are doing well and the housing market is doing well. I think in the last set of figures, every single sector of the economy grew, which has not happened for years. Even before the recession, that was a fairly unusual thing. So that economic recovery, he thinks puts him on the right side of the argument. And I think he wants this fight.
If you had to call it, though, do you think that they'll get what they want, the leadership, with this debate?
On balance, at this point, I think they will.
So do you think the main motion will pass and all the amendments will not pass? Okay.
I would probably agree with you, actually, if I had a crystal ball. I think it might be a bit closer than you think it will be.
Oh, no, I think it'll be very close.
Yeah, but I suspect that ultimately, I just hope people aren't kind of seduced by a few good sets of figures. There's an awful lot of work to do. Vince has kind of said that. Yeah. We do need to make sure that we go into the election with a practical, credible economic policy that is very different from what the Conservatives will be offering. But if you think about it as well, the Conservatives, had they been in power on their own, they would have cut 16 billion more. That was what was in their manifesto. Yeah. They were going to cut about 96 billion and we've ended up cutting about 80 odd, isn't it?
I do wonder if the coming general election is going to be the general election of the counterfactual, where, you know, we have to try and persuade people this is what would have happened if we weren't in government. And I think that's a very difficult sell. I suspect there's going to be some quite strong elements of that. I think we're all going to have to get very good at arguing that with people. Okay. Well, we actually, Karen, you touched upon it just when you were talking a little bit earlier, but there's also going to be a vote on Trident at conference. Now, I remember being on the radio a few months ago. I don't know why I got called, because I don't really know that much about Trident, but I went on and I had a bit of a chat and I kind of gave my views. But at that point, I think the party, the Federal Policy Committee, was in the process of working up a paper, and it hadn't been released at that point. But I think it has been since. How do you think that debate's going to go? I mean, I think Lib Dems are traditionally kind of against Trident, aren't they? But, I mean, is there a viable alternative, or are the Lib Dems just trying to kick it into the long grass, or is there an actual plan for what to do in a kind of concrete way that can't be characterised by the tabloids as either dithering or not making up your mind or being completely unrealistic?
Well, the thing is, well, that's what we've been doing for an awful long time, is kind of dithering and fudging. Exactly. Every time we discuss this issue, we end up with a great big pot of fudge because we don't want to make a decision. And we actually do need to actually decide where our future lies. Now, I tend to the view that spending billions and billions and billions on weapons of mass destruction is just something I don't want to be a part of. Just in my own conscience, I can't raise my hand to support that. I do not want a cruise missile with my name and on a nuclear warhead. It's just, no. If it's something that we're never going to use, why not just put that money into humanitarian aid, into those parts of the world which are most in turmoil? That would do more for the cause of peace from my point of view.
So you would be in favour of actually decommissioning Trident and not replacing it with anything, and therefore Britain would no longer be a nuclear power? You'd be okay with that?
I'd be absolutely happy with that.
Okay, Nick, I'm going to guess that you wouldn't be okay with that.
Well, you're guessing wrong, actually. Karen,
really?
I agree on this.
Wow.
Albeit for slightly different reasons. Basically, the fudge that the party reached before 2010 was that we were in favour of some sort of nuclear weapon, but not Trident. When that was actually looked at by the government, they realised there is no alternative to Trident. It's Trident or not. So, you know, you can't have, there's no point in having a few missiles, nuclear equipped missiles that you attach to planes, for example, because planes can't be a continual deterrence. And that's the sort of big buzz phrase, continual. The reason for Trident is that it's a continual at sea deterrence. It's always out there. No other countries know where the submarine is. But there is no alternative to that. If you want to keep nuclear weapons, you have to have a submarine equipped with a nuclear warhead. The reason I'm against it, therefore, is because there is no alternative. And Trident is incredibly expensive. I just don't think it's affordable anymore. We'll take a massive proportion of the defence budget at a time when the defence budget's already been squeezed because of the absolutely catastrophic state that Labour left it in. And it will take a, you know, bigger and bigger chunk of that defence budget as more cuts come down the line, putting pressure on the armed forces and the equipment that we actually do use, the aircraft that actually could enforce a no-fly zone in Syria. Or the aircraft carriers, in fact, of which we've not got any at the moment. So I think that there are much better ways to spend the money, and I've come to the view that we should scrap it. Yeah. So Karen and I agreeing.
Wow, I wasn't expecting that. So
neither was I.
The twists and turns of the House of Commons podcast. When it comes to Trident, I remember reading a very interesting blog post by Carl Minns a few months ago. Or maybe a couple of months ago, where he pointed out something I hadn't really thought about, which was that if you decide that you just want to tone down your Trident, not have as many missiles, maybe not have a submarine out there all the time, but have them ready that they could be loaded onto a submarine and then that submarine gets sent out. And he started talking through how that would actually work in reality, which is that if tensions started mounting, what would Britain do? Would Britain load up the missiles onto a submarine and then launch the submarine? Because that's just going to ratchet up tensions massively.
Exactly.
Whereas if you've got a deterrent always there and always, you know, somewhere in the ocean, that's not ratcheting up tension. That's just your default position. And I think he's absolutely right. I think either you renew Trident and you keep it pretty much as is, or really the alternative has to be that you don't have it. And it doesn't sound like there's any kind of middle ground. And I think it's quite interesting what you've said, Nick. I wonder how many of the rest of the party have come to similar conclusions. I also wonder how many people in other parties have come to similar conclusions, because, you know, I mean, the Conservatives would traditionally be for a strong nuclear deterrent, but at the same time, they're looking at the same figures that the Lib Dems are looking at.
Well, Tories are always in favour of cuts, apart from when they fall in the areas they like.
Yeah, as long as they're not the sort of, you know, they're not affecting their pet projects.
Exactly. So. I mean, I think that the primary motivation of most members will be the sort of CND type argument that, you know, about reducing the overall number of nuclear weapons in the world, which is a good argument. But I think the cost argument in these times is a persuasive one for some.
And also whether it's appropriate in the world that we face today to have those sorts of weapons. Although Shirley Williams was saying yesterday, and I asked her about this at the Scottish Liberal Democrats conference where she was doing a Q&A session, and she actually didn't answer my question, which was, would we not be better off spending the money on humanitarian aid? She didn't answer that, but she was talking about when you had the Russians and the Cold War, you needed to have something that was there the whole time.
Yes.
But you don't need that in today's world.
Yeah.
And you need to be looking at the threats that you do face and you know, working out your defences accordingly.
Yeah, I was at the Hay Festival earlier this year, and I saw Hans Blitz, the former UN Weapons Centre Inspector. So Hans Blitz said, do Germans or the Japanese feel less safe than us because they've not got nuclear weapons? You know, big, civilised, developed countries. And I think if you think about that question, I can't see how you can reach any other answer, but no, they don't feel less safe.
Yeah, there is another dimension to this, of course, which isn't necessarily going to be discussed at this conference, but it's what happens if Scotland votes for independence next year.
Mm.
It was suggested at one point that the weapons would just stay at Faz Lane rather than being shipped to Portsmouth or whatever. And that's going to be quite, which actually gave the nationalists something to think about.
Well, yeah, I think a vote for independence will certainly be a vote for unilateral disarmament for Scotland.
Well, the thing is, what do we do with the weapons that are on Faz Lane?
And yeah,
if you have an issue with joining NATO, you're not supposed to have any issues with any other powers. So that could cause a problem.
I mean, if Scotland votes for independence, basically we have to rewrite almost everything about everything that we do, don't we? Yeah. That'll be one important part of it. But
yeah, if Scotland votes for independence, the effect will not just be felt in Scotland; they'll be felt across the whole of current UK. Because I think you would find it quite hard without us.
Okay. Well, just one last question then to both of you. Obviously, there are lots of debates going on at conference here, and we've covered a few of them here. But actually, what difference do you both think the votes that are taken here now at the 2013 Federal Lib Dem Conference are going to make to government policy? I mean, we're about 20 months away from a general election. Are they going to make any difference?
I think they won't necessarily make an immediate difference to government policy, but they will make a difference to the policy that we go into the general election and to our manifesto development. And I think what's been particularly interesting is that we had a huge debate over secret courts earlier this year. The party made it overwhelmingly clear that we were against the secret courts, but they were passed anyway. They didn't affect the government's policy. But if you look in the pre-manifesto documentation, they're actually now saying that we need to find a way around this. We need to find another way of doing it. So effectively, the secret courts campaign can claim a partial victory. And that's why it's really, really important for activists in the party, when they feel strongly about an issue, to really press it, to never give up.
Yeah, and it's just worth noting, actually, that Martin Todd picked up an award on behalf of the campaign that was run by himself, Joe Shaw, Charlotte Henry and others last night. And I think that was a very well-deserved award, because, like you say, even though perhaps, you know, they didn't win the battle, they might win the war eventually.
Yeah, I think this conference is different possibly from the last few, because we're really deciding big policies for the 2015 manifesto rather than policies that can be implemented this Parliament. There's not much that we're debating in terms of big policies that will actually be implemented in the next 2 years of coalition. But we're doing some really heavy lifting in terms of putting together the really big parts of the manifesto. I don't know what you guys think, but I think another coalition is distinctly likely in 2015. So much of what we're deciding here will ultimately become government policy.
I think what will happen, actually, if there's a hung parliament and Labour's the largest party, I think they'll try and govern in a minority government. I think that will be a mistake. I think they'll be doing it as a reaction against the coalition, thinking that it'll be easier for them. I don't think it'll be easier. I think it'll be harder. I think they're underestimating just how difficult it's going to be to get stuff through. I think they're going to try and dare the Lib Dems to vote various things down. But if the Lib Dems aren't in government, then, you know, they don't have to support Labour.
But then it was very interesting from the Scottish experience, where we had 8 years, I mean, it was in very different circumstances, 8 years of a coalition of Labour and the Lib Dems. And then the SNP had a minority government. But actually, that parliament, the way it behaved was much more responsible than I think you would see at Westminster.
You wouldn't see that at Westminster. I'm sorry, maybe this sounds cynical, but...
But I think maybe there's a broader consensus in Scotland on quite a lot of issues that are devolved, you know, the health, education, things like that. Yeah, there are some policy differences, but you can make a minority government work. I'm not sure it would work in the same way at Westminster. I mean, we've seen the way that Labour behaved about the coalition, just opposing everything regardless and being, you know, really quite irresponsible and angry. And the tone was really quite immature, I think. Yeah. I think you're right. I think they will try and have a minority government because they can't stand the thought of being in coalition. But I think that it would be doomed to failure.
Yeah, minority governments don't have a happy history, do they?
Well, no, they don't. And I mean, there's that famous phrase, isn't there? You know, England doesn't love coalitions, but I don't think England loves minority governments either. No. And I think a coalition is the least worst. At least you've got a majority to get stuff done.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, next week we'll be at Labour conference down in Brighton, so you know, perhaps there can be a right of reply from some of the things that we've said this week. I suspect Emma will be listening in, so yes, that'd be good. But for now, thanks very much, Karen, for your time today. Been great.
Thank you.
And thanks, Nick.
Thank you.
And I'd just like to thank Audioboo, who very kindly host the podcast for us on the internet, and I'd like to thank Kevin McLeod at incompetech.com for our theme music. And we'll be back from Brighton next week.